This Friday is generally viewed as the target date for the Iowa legislature to adjourn. But disagreements over four top priority issues almost certainly will keep legislators in Des Moines for days, if not weeks. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll devote part of our Politics Wednesday to discussing those sticking points in the legislature. Also, President Obama defends his positions on a range of issues at a surprise press conference. And who will be the GOP's nominee for Iowa's open U.S. Senate seat in 2014? Our analysts today, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. Politics Day starts right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday here on the program. Always excited about this regular installment of River to River midweek, an installment where we pick over the national and state political landscape and analyze it. And here to help us do that this week, we have Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Hi, Tim. Welcome back.
Hey there.
Chris Larimer joining us by phone today, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Welcome to you, Chris.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
We have a mix this hour of national and state politics we want to get to, and we want to reach out to our listeners as well. When you hear something you agree with, chime in. Disagree, the same thing. We want to ask, are Iowa's state politics better or worse than our national politics? Perhaps you want to weigh in on that question. What evidence would you support, choose to point to support the opinion that you have? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's start with state politics. The Iowa legislature, this coming Friday this year, generally viewed as a target date for the legislature to adjourn. This is when, what, the per diem stops getting paid to our legislators, I believe. But there are disagreements over four top priority issues that will certainly keep the legislators in Des Moines for days, if not weeks. Chris, quickly go through the sticking points.
Well, yeah, as you mentioned, there are really four. There are three issues, and then they have to deal with the overall budget. But the three issues that have been sticking points that we knew would be starting the session are, you know, property tax, education reform, and then health care and Medicaid expansion. And also on the side is the budget. They have to agree to a budget by June 30th, the end of the fiscal year, for the new fiscal year starting July 1st. You know, the three issues right now, I guess the good news is that all three are, I believe, now in conference committee. That is, there's been a bill that's been passed in each chamber, and now it's off to a conference committee with legislators from both chambers to try to decide. But maybe the bad news is that, or at least different news, is that, you know, they're pretty far apart on these three issues. They're pretty far apart on property tax reform, very far apart on health care. And education reform, they're closer, but now they're to real sticking points. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think most legislators and the governor want to get education reform done. On property tax, that seems to be something that Governor Branstad is pushing more. And then on health care, that's something that really Democrats have been pushing hard for. Certainly Republicans have their own idea for health care, but Democrats have been really out front on that. So I think, you know, certainly they're not going to agree on all three, no matter how long they stay in the session. I think at this point, realistically, if I would bet on maybe education reform getting done, the other two being left for another session or perhaps a special session.
Let's hone in on education reform just a moment, a little closer. In his weekly news conference on Monday, Governor Branstad said it's well past time for a legislative conference committee to approve a compromise plan for education reform and send it to him for his signature.
So education reform has been in conference now for a long time. The bill actually passed the House on February 20th. The House offered a bold compromise, and then finally, after many 11 days or something like that, the Democrats came back, and then within an hour or so, Republicans have responded to that. They need to take action on that. That needs to happen now. Schools have been waiting way too long, and it's not just about money. If you look at, and the Register had quite an article about this over the weekend, Iowa has been dead last in terms of growth and student achievement over the last decade or so. We've got to change that, and that's why we need to have the reforms and the accountability and this new opportunity for teacher leadership.
Governor Branstad on Monday of this week at his regular press conference. As you mentioned there, Chris, one of the big issues preventing adjournment of this legislative session, education reform. You heard the governor say there, accountability. It needs to be part of the education reform, and that's where the lawmakers in the democratically controlled Senate and the Republican controlled House can't seem to reach agreement. I wonder if you could flesh out what accountability means in this context, Chris.
Well, yeah, the big sticking point here with accountability is the use of test scores for teacher evaluations, and that's where the bill seems to be bogged down at this point, because before it was an argument about allowable growth and whether or not there's going to be 2% or 4%. Now it seems that they at least have a way to get to 4% allowable growth for the next fiscal year with a 2% and 2% allotment. But now the sticking point is really on, you know, teacher evaluations, and the House Republican plan wants to include test scores as part of that evaluation. Senate Democrats do not. They're getting
Why don't Democrats like linking the teacher pay to test scores?
Well, they're getting a lot of pushback from the Teachers Association, ISEA, and that's a very powerful lobby in Iowa, has been for a long time. And so if they're against it, as a Senate Democrat, you have to be careful about endorsing a plan that would allow for test scores, because you're going to get pushback from that interest group.
Mm-hmm. And the Republicans like this idea, this linkage. Why?
Well, the accountability part of it, the test score part of it, has been something they've been behind for a long time. It's an outcome measure that they're in favor of, and it's something that there's just a philosophical disagreement with Teachers Association on, and has been for a long time.
Tim Hagel on this issue, education reform in Iowa.
Well, from the Republican perspective, they basically don't resist putting more money into education necessarily, but they want to see some results. And this is what the clip from Governor Branstad was talking about, is that if we haven't shown improvement in scores, then it seems the idea is, or the argument is, that you're not getting any bang for your buck. From the teacher's perspective, aside from many other reasons, so teachers may not want to be judged on test scores, not all of the reasons for student achievement is within their control. That people will talk about how it depends on the home environment, depends on whether parents are encouraging students to do so forth, and teachers can only do so much. And so they feel that if they're being judged based on test scores, that it's not something that they can really do that much about. But on the other hand, again, from the Republican side of things, that there needs to be some sort of a balance between achievement and money spent.
Mm-hmm. Do we know where the public stands on this issue here in Iowa?
Well, it's probably a mix of things. That certainly the teachers and the teachers' unions have made their case in a variety of ways, and talking about that it shouldn't be based on test scores and so forth. But then again, you do get the Republicans can make a case for saying, well, we want to have better students. We need to have our students prepared not only to go to college but to enter a more technologically oriented world in terms of the employment market. And so both sides can make their case, and it kind of depends on who has the better messaging as far as who's going to win at any particular issue in point mm-hmm. in time.
I wonder, Chris, if Iowa can look to other states that have successfully implemented some of the things that are being suggested in these different visions.
Yeah, they may. I'm not familiar on the details of other states' plans, but they certainly could. We know that New Jersey has tried various issues with education reform or teacher pay, and they could certainly look around the country. We always talk about states being the laboratories of democracy, and so of course they can look around. But this is going to be an Iowa issue, and like I said, this is probably the one that's closest to the agreement of the big three, but it's down to that last stumbling block, and it's a very big block at this point.
Okay. Education reform, one of the stumbling blocks, one of the sticking points in the Iowa legislature this year that we're talking about early in the program on Politics Wednesday with Chris Larimer and Tim Hagel. Let's focus for a moment on health care. Chris Larimer, In the state, before we sort of expand this to a national context, in the state of Iowa, remind us what's going on. We have competing visions of health care there, don't
Absolutely.
We?
Absolutely, yeah. So for the Senate Democrats, or the Senate controlled by the Democrats, they've passed a bill calling for Medicaid expansion. This is part of the Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act that expands health care coverage for up to 138% of the poverty line as far as income. And then on the Republican side, on the House side, which is controlled by Republicans, they've passed a different plan. And this is the Healthy Iowa plan that has been pushed by Governor Branstad. It was introduced by Representative Walt Rogers in the Iowa House and just passed. And so now this is – and the Senate Democrats have passed their Medicaid expansion plan. So now this has gone to conference committee, but very sharp disagreements. The Medicaid expansion is part of – linked to a federal plan in which Medicaid would be expanded to a large number of Iowans, as I said, up to 138% of the poverty line. This would be fully financed by the federal government, the expansion, for 3 years, and then the funding would drop off to 90% after that and go down slowly after that. The plan introduced by Walt Rogers and backed by the governor would provide health insurance up to 100%, as I understand it, of the poverty line, and then provide a subsidy for the 100 to 138% of the poverty line. There would be additional costs there, but the big difference between what Governor Branstad and the House Republicans want to do and what the Senate Democrats want to do is that Governor Branstad, really in his own words, does not trust the federal government to come through with that money. And there is a very big concern that if they adopt the Medicaid expansion, that if federal spending gets tight, that the federal government will not be able to fully fund the Medicaid expansion, and therefore the state will be on the hook for a significant amount of money.
River to River listeners, what do you think about these two visions of health care in Iowa, the expansion of Medicaid or the governor's plan? Weigh in on what we've been discussing here. 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Healthcare is something that affects us all, is relevant to all of us in the nation and in the state. We're also on Facebook if you'd like to post something there, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Interesting, gentlemen, Chris and Tim, a new poll just out yesterday indicates that many Americans are still unclear about the details of this new law, the Affordable Health Care Law, in some cases even unaware it's actually the law of the land. This is according to a Kaiser Family Foundation health tracking poll. Here, some surprising findings that, listen, a whopping 42% of Americans do not know that the Affordable Care Act is, in fact, law. Included in that 42%, 12% believe it has been repealed by Congress. 7% think the U.S. Supreme Court overturned it, and 23% are unsure of its status. Now, for the record, no portion of the law has been repealed, and the Supreme Court did weigh in on it. It upheld it last summer in a 5-4 decision. Now, polling shows the law continues to be viewed more negatively than positively, just 35% saying they have a favorable view of it, 40% saying they have an unfavorable one. Tim Hagel, you're grinning with the implications of these perceptions. Have we had a law implemented with these sorts of misunderstandings and lack of public support going into it?
Well, I'm grinning for two reasons. One, going back to our earlier discussion that maybe we in political science need to have some achievement tests too for people that have come out. But part of the problem, of course, is that not all aspects of the law have been implemented yet. And we're sort of waiting for things to be rolled out. We're waiting for regulations to occur. And there's a lot of confusion as to and argument back and forth between Republicans and Democrats as far as what the law is actually going to do, what it has done, and so forth. And so that's why it's not entirely surprising that the people are pretty confused about, well, is it in place? Has it happened? Maybe I haven't seen anything yet. But on the other hand, some people maybe have had their hours cut back as small businesses try to avoid that 50-employee limit where they're going to be on the hook for additional funds and so forth. So it's just an unclear thing. And, you know, as current Senator Max Baucus, who's now retiring from Montana, suggested as one of the authors of the thing, that it's basically a train wreck at this point.
Mm. What about you, Chris? This public perception influence on the implementation of the Affordable Health Care Law?
Well, I think it's dead on, and I agree with Tim. I mean, this has really been sort of a public relations disaster for the president in terms of how it was rolled out, because this is something that there is still a lot of confusion. It's a very complicated bill. As Tim mentioned, most of it hasn't even gone into effect yet, so there's confusion about what's actually happening. And really, the White House, I think, might agree that they haven't done the best job of messaging on how the healthcare reform is going to work. They're just this last week they've released a new shorter form, supposedly easier to understand for those who would be receiving subsidies to get health insurance, because the initial form that was released was very long and very complicated. So I think part of this just goes back to the messaging surrounding health care.
Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100. Clara is joining us from Springville. Hi, Clara. What's your view on this?
Well, I'd like their view on what the governor is doing. He was really not attached to this expansion of Medicaid issue. The 70 organizations are supporting the Senate version, particularly with the compromise, which basically says if the federal government goes broke, we'll pick up the costs. And it reminds me of the way Branstad approached the lottery issue several years ago, when there was a lot of public support for the lottery. It passed. He vetoed it. Then the support built up. I think he vetoed it twice, I'm not sure, before he passed it. It just seems inexplicable to me about what he's doing. And what was failed to be mentioned here was that his plan, the Healthy Iowa plan, would reallocate monies, taking, for example, $40 million from UIHC. So, you know, where is Terry coming from on this? That's what I kind of like to have your people address.
Let's get a reaction to
it. I'll take the reaction off the air. Thank you.
Clara, thank you for listening and for your input.
Okay.
From Springville. Chris, what do you have to say to Clara's comment?
Well, I think it's a good question. You know, he is there is quite a bit of politics involved here, and certainly this is an issue that could potentially be a larger issue come 2014 for the gubernatorial race here in Iowa. You know, he unlike several other Republican governors, he's held firm in his position against Medicaid expansion. You know, at this point, he's pushing his own bill. If the Healthy Iowa plan is rejected, if you know, Medicaid, you know, if he's basically forced to accept Medicaid expansion, it may be something that at least he can say he tried. But again, this is kind of a little bit of game of chicken. And you know, if he's able to get the Healthy Iowa plan through, it looks great. It's a big policy achievement for Governor Branstad. If he's forced to accept Medicaid expansion, it could potentially be viewed as a loss. On the other hand, if he's forced to accept it because the federal government will not, you know, accept the Healthy Iowa plan, you know, he can at least go back to voters and say he tried his own version of health care that was very much different than Obamacare, which, as you mentioned, still has a lot of uncertainty surrounding it, at least within the public.
Tim Hagel, what do you see as the alternate paths there? Do you agree with those?
Yeah, I want to get away a little bit from the politics of it, although it's very hard to do. But basically, it's a matter of, as we were saying before, where I think the governor is looking at this from a fiscal responsibility point of view, and that in the short term, yes, maybe it sounds good to have the federal government to pick up 100% for 3 years and 90% after that, but given the debt and deficit problems we're having at the federal level, and we're not sure how that's going to shake out in the long term, we as a state, the governor may be thinking, don't want to be on the hook for this money because it will be considered an entitlement, and then states would not be able to afford it. And so the better long-term view would be to say, make it fiscally responsible now so that we can have this in place going forward regardless of what the federal government does. So again, there are going to be people that are going to disagree with that for political reasons of various sorts and for policy reasons. But like I say, I think that that's what my guess is what the governor is thinking. And as far as some other Republican governors that accepted it, their states are not in as solid a fiscal position as Iowa is, so they really can't turn down that money. So their hands are more tied than those are in Iowa.
Suzanne is joining us from Ames. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine. What's your opinion on this or your question?
Well, you know, I will just give you part of my opinion here because it runs very long.
And we're coming up on a break, too, Suzanne. Tell us what you're thinking.
Well, you know, there is a lot of confusion about...
Sorry, Suzanne, that was my fault. Please start again, Suzanne. I'm sorry.
Sure. There is so much confusion in Iowa, as there are in a few other states, about the entire health care reform issue. First, Branstad couldn't make up his mind if he wanted state-run exchanges, if he wanted privately-run exchanges, nonprofit-run exchanges. You know, that's still somewhere halfway in the works. He didn't seem too very concerned about federal money going away when he fought so hard to keep the Air Guard wing here with their F-16s. You know, that wasn't an issue for him. I think what has happened is that he, on the Medicaid expansion, he simply dug his heels in, wanted to be a good example for the Republican National Governors Conference. No, National Republican Governors Conference as their current chair to say, this is Republican ideology. Okay. I'm setting the good example here. I think he's doing a horrendous disservice to people in Iowa who are poor, in bad health, disabled, and, you know, woe be to him, I think.
Suzanne, thank you for your opinion from Ames. Mike in Fort Dodge. Coming up on a break, Mike, I think you want to weigh in on the education reform topic we had a few minutes ago.
Sure. That's right.
Go ahead, please.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought you were going to take a break.
No, we're coming up on a break. That's why I need to have you hurry a little bit.
Okay, I'll hurry. I was just going to make a comment about the teacher evaluation. You know, since that in No Child Left Behind, it just seems like, you know, there's I think in Massachusetts where the teachers were caught, you know, teaching to the test, you know, just to save their job. And I've been in education for 30 years. When they take, like, the Iowa Test of Basic Skills, they throw in every child, whether they can read or not, is in the mix on those scores. And you don't hear very many people talking about making the classroom smaller. You know, a lot of teachers now have 25 to 30 kids, and it's pretty hard to control them behaviorally, let alone.
Mm-hmm. And you think that's, as an educator for several decades, you think that is the key to better quality schools and teaching?
Oh, I definitely believe that it does help. And also having teacher aides in the classroom to help them. So if the money's going anywhere, it should be to hire more teachers and things like that.
And are you against linking teacher pay to test scores?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Why?
Because I think it's just not a fair evaluation, because kids are all over the board in their capabilities and their, you know, not sure of the word here, but, you know, just what they're capable of doing. And when you put that in the mix of all that, it's hard to determine a fair score.
Okay, Mike, that's what also in part this program is about. Mike in Fort Dodge, thank you very much. We're going to go away for a few minutes and come back. And when we do, we want to talk about something that happened yesterday that political reporter Glenn Thrush described as follows. Well, I'll just tell you what it is. President Obama's surprise news conference yesterday, in the words of the political reporter, if ever 47 minutes illustrated the frustration, tantalizing promise, and ambivalence of a second term, this was it. So when we come back, we'll hear a couple bits from the president from his surprise news conference talking about many things, the Syria, the use of sarin gas, now evidently evidence for that, gun legislation, immigration, sequester cuts, and also continued efforts to shutter the Guantanamo Bay detention facility over the objections of congressional Republicans and Democrats. We'd like to have you weigh in on these or other political issues that you've got. 1-866-780-9100. Tim Hagel with us from the University of Iowa. Chris Larimer from the University of Northern Iowa. Also in our second half, we want to talk about that 2014 open U.S. Senate seat in Iowa. Senator Tom Harkin retiring. The GOP having some difficulties finding someone who will look for the nominee, who will look toward the nomination of their party. We'll get our thoughts from Tim Hagel and Chris Larimer when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, actually, I take the show on the road. We're going to have a conversation with Thomas Schwartz, the director of the Presidential Library, Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, talking about the role of presidential libraries in light of the fact the George W. Bush Library opening in Texas last week. We'll also learn about the new Iowa's role in the Civil War exhibit that is opening at the Presidential Museum tomorrow on this program. Of course, today, Politics Wednesday, Tim Hagel with us from the University of Iowa, Chris Larimer at the University of Northern Iowa, our analysts for this week. want to bring a little closure to our discussion of more local politics, state politics, that we had in our first half hour. A couple of emails to share with you. Judy in Hiawatha writes, as we discussed education reform, also health care reform in our first half hour. Judy in Hiawatha writing, if teachers are evaluated and paid based on test scores, who will want to work in the low-achieving schools? Those schools often have the hardest-working teachers and the neediest children. Won't a test score evaluation be punishing students, parents, and professionals? Kathleen writes, this is the second maddening cut-nose-to-spite-faced throwback of federal funds by Branstad. The first was extension of the rail service from Chicago through Iowa, and now this turndown of Medicaid help. Whose side is he on, asks Kathleen. It seems the governor is far more interested in the wealth care of the health industry and far less interested in the health of Iowans. We had several callers we couldn't get to either. Obviously, we'll have to address this in shows to come. But thank you for that input as well. Let's go back to talk, pivot over to national politics. The president's having a surprise news conference yesterday addressing a whole range of issues. We can't get to all of them, but one reporter asking the president, do you have the juice to get the rest of this agenda through the Congress? And he jested, maybe I should just pack up and go home. And then I think he quoted Mark Twain about the rumors of his early demise. President Obama also used the news conference yesterday to renew his call to close the detention center for enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay, despite previous failed attempts to close the facility, something he campaigned on in 2008. The president says he will try again.
I'm going to go back at this. I've asked my team to review everything that's currently being done in Guantanamo, everything that we can do administratively, and I'm going to reengage with Congress to try to make the case that this is not something that's in the best interest of the American people. The idea that we would still maintain forever a group of individuals who have not been tried, that is contrary to who we are, it is contrary to our interests, and it needs to stop.
A hunger strike by the majority of prisoners being held in Guantanamo has brought attention to this issue. Tim Hagel, how likely is he to succeed in this attempt? Has support in Congress changed? Perhaps in the wake of the Boston Marathon bombing, that would be hard to imagine.
Yeah, the timing of this is very odd, but I think it may have been forced on the president to some extent. Raising this issue after the Boston bombing is not good, but on the other hand, because of the hunger strike, it puts the issue in the news again. And certainly this is one of the things where the president's base has criticized him since he promised that he would immediately close Guantanamo Bay, and that didn't happen. And it became a bit of an issue in the last presidential election, so it's something that maybe he thinks that he can get a handle on. But I've heard a lot of Republican commentators saying, yes, yes, please raise this as an issue because they think it will be a winner for them in the midterm elections.
Mm-hmm. Now one of the points is that we don't want these people on U.S. territory, proper U.S. territory in the United States. I wonder, though, when I hear that, people's question would probably naturally be, we have some of the most heinous criminals in our domestic criminals in our federal prisons. How does a terrorist match up to them? Why can't we hold them as well?
Well, that's the argument that the president and those that are in support of Guantanamo Bay are making, is saying, well, look, we've got all these other terrorists and domestic terrorists and heinous criminals here, and we've handled it in the justice system, so we should be able to do it for these folks as well. But I think that there's the view of those that oppose closing Guantanamo Bay is that it's fundamentally different when you've got foreign nationals that are basically enemy combatants. And I shouldn't use that term since we've now used it in a different context in terms of how we handle them judicially and so forth. But basically foreign fighters that we have captured in some particular way. But on the other hand, the question is, well, what are we going to do with them? Are we going to just keep this number of people in this separate jail indefinitely forever until they eventually die of old age or are old enough that they feel it's safe to release them? So it's one of those complex problems that the president's had to deal with. But again, since he promised that he would close it, he feels that he needs to try to move on that issue.
Chris Larimer, your thoughts on the Gitmo issue?
Well, yeah, I do think it was absolutely forced on him with the attention given to the hunger strike, where I think they were talking, 160 out of 166 prisoners on a hunger strike, very serious hunger strike, where you have doctors coming in and reportedly force-feeding some of these prisoners. You know, and I think the other side of it is logistics as far as the likelihood of closing it. You know, if they decide to close it, well, you still have to send those individuals to their home countries, and getting those home countries to accept these individuals is an entirely other issue. So I think there are political issues with Congress, and there are logistical issues. And so I think this is going to be something that's going to be difficult for the president to achieve.
Okay, let's go to another topic that the president addressed in that press conference yesterday, one of many. Syria, at the surprise news conference yesterday, President Obama cautioned against rushing to judgment about the use of chemical weapons in Syria.
What we now have is evidence that chemical weapons have been used inside of Syria, but we don't know how they were used, when they were used, who used them. We don't have a chain of custody that establishes what exactly happened. And when I am making decisions about America's national security and the potential for taking additional action in response to chemical weapon use, I've got to make sure I've got the facts. That's what the American people would expect.
President Obama yesterday in a news conference. So remind us of the position now and how it's perhaps changed a little bit since the discovery of, we don't know the details, but the use of chemical weapons in Syria, sarin gas. What is the position the administration is in right now, Tim Hagel?
Well, I saw a tweet yesterday that basically summed up the shorter Obama, which is regarding Syria, which is basically that all his options stink, although they used a different word at the end there. And that's the problem, is that the president came out early on and he took a fairly bold position saying, look, if there's chemical weapons, that's a red line, that's a game changer, which gives the strong impression that he would do something, his administration would do something to, you know, alleviate that particular problem. Now, it wasn't clear what that something was, but maybe the president was hoping that there wouldn't be a use of chemical weapons. But now all of a sudden that there is, and he's saying, you know, well, now, wait a minute, we've got to make sure there's a chain of custody and, you know, kind of thing. He's basically seemingly waffling on this. And he was also asked during the press conference, well, you know, what does this game changer mean? You said it was going to be a game changer. What does that mean? Well, we're going to rethink our options, which is a big nothing in the view of especially a lot of Republicans. Now, on the other hand, Republicans aren't exactly in a position where they're going to want to send troops into Syria, and that's pretty much not going to happen. So the president's in this tough position as, well, I want to do something. I want to, you know, prevent the chemical weapons from being used, but what are we going to do? Are we going to start sending drones over there, troops? No, can't send troops. So it's basically no good options.
And I have to believe, I have no polling figures in front of me, but with Afghanistan, with Iraq, with Libya, very cautious about any intervention. Chris Larimer.
Absolutely. And as Tim said, you know, he really did set himself up poorly, I guess, in this position by saying that the use of chemical weapons was going to be a red line. Now, you know, you have Secretary of Defense Hagel and now the president obviously saying that they do believe chemical weapons were used. But what's the next step? And, you know, there's already, you know, non-military aid being supply to the rebel opposition in Syria. Do you go beyond that? What do you do? I mean, at this point, he set himself up to say that we are going to increase our response or provide an additional response. But all those additional responses, you know, like the tweet that Tim was referring to, are not good and probably, as you suggested, not popular. And so I think, you know, this is a very tough position, and I would, you know, I'd be surprised, I guess, if he does take more aggressive action. But that's what he set up for himself.
Chris Larimer with us of the University of Northern Iowa, winding up the hour with Chris and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, our political analysts this week on Politics Wednesday. Let's move on to another topic, back to more state Iowa focused politics, and let's talk about that U.S. Senate seat being vacated by Senator Tom Harkin, and we're looking forward to that campaign, that election in 2014. Let's go back to the news conference that the governor had on Monday. He was asked whether he might consider a run for the U.S. Senate seat being vacated by Senator Tom Harkin. His lieutenant governor, we remember, Kim Reynolds, announced that she would not be seeking the GOP nomination. Branstad said he had no plans to run, and then he went on to describe who he thought would be the ideal candidate. And his words have raised some eyebrows. Let's listen back to this. This is a back and forth between Branstad and State House reporters this past Monday.
I'm confident we're going to find a really good candidate. And I really believe that Iowans want somebody that will serve in the Senate that will be an Iowa problem solver, not another congressman. We, you know, Congress is a mess. We've seen them spend $1 trillion more than they've taken in every year. And so the Democrats have decided, well, we're going to send up another congressman. That's the last thing we need is another congressman in the United States Senate. Well, I'm just saying, I think the contrast of having an Iowa problem solver versus somebody that's had all of their service in Washington, D.C. in the Congress would be a very good thing for Republicans. Well, I mean, remember, Steve King did serve at the state Senate level and was very effective here. And it's a little different thing than Braley. That's all his service has been in Washington, D.C. during the time that they passed all these massive deficits. He voted against free trade agreements, and I think his record is one that will be a pretty easy target.
Governor Brandstatter back and forth with reporters this past Monday at a press conference. A lot there to pick apart. Let me take you, Chris Larimer, to have the first pickings there. The first comment, I think he said it three times, not wanting another congressman to represent Iowa in the Senate. Something that those reporters, we couldn't hear the audio very well, something they latched on to right away. Do you read anything into these comments about whether or not he wants obviously a target, Bruce Braley of the 1st District, but what about Republican Congressman Steve King seeking the GOP nomination of the 5th District?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. That's hard to know if that was sort of an indirect shot at Congressman Steve King. I think it more reflects Governor Branstad's just distrust of the federal government, distrust of Congress. You know, I think he's also setting Bruce Braley up and you know, that the optics or the imaging of it that, you know, anybody in Congress is out of touch with sort of the interests of the American people. And so, you know, you always run against Congress. I think he's just setting up the campaign in that way. So I'm not sure if he was really taking a shot at Steve King or just more the idea that Congressman Braley is a member of Congress and trying to set up the idea that he somehow doesn't understand the interests of ordinary Iowans. I think on the other hand, you know, for the Republican Party, they're starting to run out of options maybe a little bit, in the sense that we know that, you know, at least Kim Reynolds, Lieutenant Governor Reynolds, has said she will not seek the office. Secretary of Agriculture Bill Northey seems unlikely or hasn't had a lot of statements saying that he is going to run. There's been rumors about Secretary of State Matt Schultz, although we haven't really seen any statements on his behalf. So, you know, they're starting to run out of options a little bit. If Steve King would run, certainly he's well-known. Love him or hate him, certainly well-known in Western Iowa. He might have difficulty running across a statewide campaign. You know, we've heard other names mentioned. State Senator Joni Ernst from Southwest Iowa, Red Oak, has been mentioned. You know, it's a tough race. I mean, and you know, and I think it is tied to what's happening with the governor's race next year as well, where you see Democrats running out of options. Democrats have not put anybody forward, really, for the governor's race. And it's going to be a tight race. You know, we just saw today that the new numbers released from the Secretary of State's office on party registration in Iowa among active voters, there's a less than a tenth of a percentage point difference between active Democrats and active Republicans in the state. Still no party leads both groups. But so you still have it's going to be a very tight statewide race, and I think the Republican Party is trying to figure out who's going to be the best candidate.
Mm-hmm. Back to that list of potential GOP contenders for the Senate, the open Senate race, the nomination there. I think also adding to that list, David Young, chief of staff to U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, said he's interested in running. If Steve King and Iowa Agriculture Secretary Bill Northey opt out, your view on this whole search for a GOP nominee, or at least someone who is willing to run in some sort of primary? Tim Hagel.
Yeah, I had seen the article on David Young, and it's somebody in his position, having been Grassley's chief of staff, is certainly familiar with a lot of the issues that you're going to face at the federal level.
But he's not a household name.
But that's his problem, is that he's not well known. Now, he may be well known within the state for sort of like the power players, and that's going to give him a head start in certain ways. But on the other hand, it's the grassroots folks that are going to have to do the groundwork for him, and that's where he's going to have a real problem. Another other name in the list, of course, is Matt Whitaker, who has expressed an interest and made some moves towards putting a campaign together. But the problem for all of these folks really is that they're all waiting to see what Congressman King is going to do, that if King is in, it basically will clear the field because of his fundraising power and name recognition. It would make it very difficult for any other candidate to basically confront him. Not impossible, but it would make it more difficult. But if King is out, and rumor is that we may hear something about this soon. I don't know how soon that is, but soon that then we may see some quick movements on the part of other folks. On the other hand, it's still fairly early. And as some of the articles that have talked about this topic before have indicated, that sometimes you have these early leaders that maybe express an interest, don't gain any traction, and kind of fade out. And so you have people that maybe jump in late that people hadn't thought about before and all of a sudden express an interest and get in and ultimately successful, at least in getting a nomination, if not winning an election.
What could we imagine Congressman King is waiting for? What kind of inputs does he still need? And you said that decision may be coming soon that he doesn't have. Do you imagine Chris Larimer?
Well, I think it's probably, you know, internal polling on his part. He knows he's going to do well in rural counties. He just needs to see what his image is like in more urban counties and particularly the eastern part of the state. You know, looking at some of the larger counties, whether it's Polk, Blackhawk, Lynn, you know, Dubuque counties, you know, how big a loss can he project that he would take in those counties and will be offset by what's going on in the rural counties?
Mm-hmm.
I think, and you know, because again, his name recognition, people know who he is. He just needs to figure out what sort of voter is he going to appeal to. And I will say, one of my students made a great point, a student in Iowa politics class, about name recognition and the fact that Bill Northey might have the best shot at this because his name is on every single gas station in the state when you fill up.
that is true. Back to the comment about Governor Branstad's comments on the ideal candidate. For this, for the GOP, he said the ideal candidate would be, if we remember that clip, an Iowa problem solver, which seems to be indicating someone who has experience in Iowa politics. But the words problem solver also seem to be a bit problematic, aren't they, for Congressman King, who hasn't really earned a reputation in Congress for bringing two parties together, bridging the bipartisan divide, a partisan divide, to get legislation approved. Tim Hagel?
Well, it's one of those phrases that, you know, it's hard to say specifically what the governor had in mind or what he was thinking about in terms of what problems were being solved. But it's one of those phrases that you can say that if Congressman King, okay, he hasn't done this or he hasn't done that. Mm-hmm. And that was certainly one of the attacks that Christy Vilsack made against him in her race in the 4th District, new 4th District. But on the other hand, if you think of it in terms of, well, he's, you know, stood up for his various policy positions and maybe that's a good thing, although that's not necessarily a problem solver. Of course, the governor did say that Congressman King was very effective as a member of the Iowa legislature. So, you know, it's one of those things that you can kind of point to some things and other people point to other things. And so it's not as clear as it could be, at least in a case like that, as opposed to maybe somebody who, whether it's Northey or Whitaker or Schultz, who have attacked particular problems and found success with them.
Mm-hmm. And the Senate is also a chamber that requires, if anything, more a bipartisan work, does it not, Chris Larimer?
Yeah, I think it does. And, you know, things move a bit differently through the Senate. I mean, things take a little bit longer to get through. You know, you have more power as an individual senator. But, yeah, you absolutely have to be able to work, certainly now more than ever, in a bipartisan way because everything really needs 60 votes to get anything done.
With Congressman Bruce Braley running for this vacant U.S. Senate seat in 2014, we have just a minute or two left. Who is likely to run for Bruce Braley's vacant seat, the 1st District of Iowa? Chris, your thoughts, and then we'll go to Tim as we finish up this hour.
Yeah, you know, there have been a few names that have, you know, that have come out, whether it's State Senator Liz Mathis or State Senator Jeff Danielson. Pat Murphy, a member of the legislature from Dubuque, has declared that he will run on the Democratic side for Congressman Braley's seat, but you know, this is a Democratic district. You know, just again, looking at the party registration numbers here, you know, you have about a 4.5 percentage point advantage among Democrats over Republicans within the 1st District. So it's likely going to go to a Democrat, but, you know, there's going to be some jockeying for position. And particularly if you see a state senator run, and it's a Democrat, they have to be careful because then they're going to try to make sure that they fill that state Senate seat with a Democrat to not lose control of the Iowa State Senate. And so I think there's still quite a bit of politicking going on for that race.
On that congressional seat that will open up, Tim Hagel, your thoughts, the GOP not really having a hope of capturing it, or perhaps?
Well, I think they have a hope, but the thing is they've got to have a strong candidate, obviously, because of the Democratic voter advantage. But on the other hand, with even with the interest in the Senate seat, with Governor Branstad, who's fairly popular despite arguments that you have with certain issues, he'll be sort of leading the ticket. It'll probably be more of a Republican year than Democratic year, and so there's a possibility. But again, has to be a strong GOP candidate.
Okay, thank you very much. This hour, a footnote as we end, got an email from A.J. Spiker, the chair of the Republicans of Iowa today. He said that the tickets are sold out for the spring dinner on May 10th featuring keynote speaker Rand Paul. I think they opened up a couple more tables May 10th. As a programming note, I am scheduled to talk with Rand Paul on this program next week. So be sure to tune in for that, all you political junkies. Chris Larimer of UNI. Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, thank you both for joining us.
Welcome.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.